Good evening. Welcome to Writers at Warwick. It's a double pleasure, at least double, to be sitting next to Germaine Greer this evening, because not only is she a guest in this series, but she's a professor here. She's just come back to Warwick, to the Department of English and Comparative Literary Studies and the Centre for British and Comparative Cultural Studies and another graduate centre, the Centre for the Study of Women and Gender. She holds a professorship in all three of those places, as only Germaine Greer could. It's a return, of course. She was here when she wrote The Female Eunuch. We think we've got a pretty good university here, but I doubt if anybody I doubt if all of us put together have written a book which could have had such an impact. It had a huge impact on my thinking when it first appeared. I know plenty of people who would say not enough of an impact, but to me it was quite a big impact. And it's influenced people all over the world in all sorts of ways. One person that I know of, and I think Germaine knows of, is the novelist Celia Brayfield, who wrote recently in The Independent something that she'd already told me privately, which was that when The Female Eunuch appeared, she, Celia Brayfield, was a non-novelist, in an abusive marriage, being beaten up by her husband, with a child who was suffering from this fraught situation. And when she read The Female Eunuch, she thought, I don't have to live like this. And she walked out on her abusive husband with her child, moved into a council flat and started to write novels, and has done very well since. So that's a book that you all know, and many of you, like me, will have been influenced by. There are a whole lot of other books that Germaine has written, and I don't need to mention them because you know of them and have read them. You may not know some of her work, her scholarly work, with little-known women writers, particularly of the 17th century, editing and publishing at her own publishing house, the work of writers like Catherine Phillips and Anne Wharton in beautiful editions with the most loving and attentive and informative and scholarly annotation and introductions. She's also now working, she's a tough scholar and a hard critic, and she's now, to my horror, working on The Earl of Rochester, whom I dared to say some things about a long time ago, which I'm sure will be straightened out when her new book appears in the Writers and Their Work series. But she's here this evening to talk about her next book, which is called The Whole Woman, and which revisits, I guess, some of the territory she was exploring in The Female Eunuch. But if my guess is wrong, we'll learn soon enough. She'll talk, she'll read some of this unpublished work to us. She'll then answer questions. And if there's time at the end of all that, she'll be here with the bookseller who'll be selling copies of her work. And we're very privileged in that she doesn't usually sign copies of her work at gatherings like this, but because she's one of our own, she's agreed to do it tonight. Welcome, Germaine.
Thank you. Know how to begin. I feel like beginning with an apology, because what you're going to be subjected to in the first months of next year is an unbelievable hype for my new book. This is not of my engineering. It is to do with the people who work with authors and earn their living by authors and who study the market. We all know in the late 20th century that the market rules. Some of us writhe under this dictum. I am told I should be glad of it. When I was catching a plane to America 10 days ago, I came across David Hare struggling to get British Airways to allow him to occupy the seat he had paid for. I joined in the struggle trying to persuade British Airways to bump him up, saying he is England's best known player. Can't do this to David Hare. And they said, glasses full. But he's on the flight, they said. Yes, but he's paid for a club glass seat, doesn't want to sit on the toilet, if you don't mind. And in the course of this negotiation, which failed as far as I could tell, I confessed to David that I was horrified at the thought of next March, because one of the things my publishers are going to do is to have exhibits in major underground stations. They're going to have huge posters of the cover of the book, and they're going to give commuters a chapter from the book to read on the train. And I said, I'm going to have to emigrate, but I'm not allowed. I've got to stay here. I'm committed to help them promote the book. And he said, are you mad? He said, if anybody would do anything like that for a book of mine, I'd be delighted. So I thought, oh, you always want, I guess, the devil that you don't know. Because you know what happens when a book is hyped in that way is that there have to be spoilers. Because this is how the market works. So conscious are my publishers that they need spoilers that they are not distributing any bound proofs. There will be no books available until there are finished copies, which is an attempt to stop a newspaper running a spoiler. Greer's book contains X, Y, and Z. It's all crap. We've read it all before, blah, blah, blah. So poor old, I hear my saying poor old. My publishers are Doubleday. That's the imprint. The house is Transworld. The owner is Bertelsmann, who now owns also Random House and has become the biggest publisher in the world. We all have anxious thoughts about this, anxious thoughts about the imposition of a single criterion. It's very easy for authors who are being published and promoted to think that they have risen to the top by sheer force of genius, and it's just wonderful that the market has recognized that that's what it is. But I always remember my father, who used to say bleakly, the scum also rises. So the fact that I'm going to be marketed with such vim and vigor doesn't mean that my book is necessarily good. I can tell you that the book is the best I could do, but I'm 60 next birthday, and we have it rammed down our throats every day that we ain't what we used to be. Whether we're Bob Dylan or Elvis Costello or whoever, we've probably gone cold. I don't think that I have gone cold, and I don't think either that I've had some kind of voyage to Damascus and seen the error of my ways. The Female Eunuch was a book largely misunderstood. Most people didn't take on board what the argument was really about. They didn't understand the distinction that I drew between the female and the feminine, between the female as another sex and the feminine as a castrated proto-sex. They never got the idea that I was arguing for women's right to recognize their own sexuality. They thought what I was doing was telling people to go out and fuck as much as they possibly could, which is not what I was saying at all. What I was saying was that you should do what you want to do, and you should want to do what you do. You shouldn't be talked into things. You shouldn't be reactive. You shouldn't be simply responsive. You should understand that there is in you a libido, a questing thing that wants to find out how the world is, wants to acquire power. I never, ever wanted to write a sequel to The Female Eunuch. Those of you who can remember it at all might remember that in the introduction, I said I hoped the book would obsolesce very quickly, that it would be replaced by better books, better books that were better argued and better informed. And I can tell you that it has been replaced by such books. But they are not popular books, and they have not been marketed in the right sort of way, and they have not been accessible to the same public. I've always thought of myself as arguing a prima facie case for feminism. Nowadays we talk of feminisms. We understand that the nature of the feminist case is so contradictory, so contorted, so responsive to pre-existing political realities, that we still haven't got the questions right, let alone come along with the answers. So you can imagine the consternation of intellectual feminists when we read in our newspapers that feminism has gone too far, that feminism is finished, that it is now time for a retreat to some kind of heterosexual, safe middle ground. When, as far as we're concerned, we haven't even begun to understand what it is that has to happen before women's lives will be full, human, creative lives. Now, I knew that hundreds of books have been published that have dealt with the questions I raised in 1969 in a more cogent, more sophisticated way. Usually, I may say, supported by the intellectual instrumentalities developed by academic disciplines. Academic disciplines themselves are masculinist to some extent, but the people I'm talking about were well aware of that and well aware of the way they had to conduct this discourse. But what was happening at the popular level? Well, there were good books that had a success. Susan Faludi's Backlash had a success and should have had, for example. But at the same time, there was a kind of growing consensus that was coming even from people like Faye Weldon, whom I love and honor, who was saying, oh, men are hurting, it's time to stop. If men were never going to hurt, we would never have got anywhere. If the system didn't privilege one sex over another, there was no point in the battle in the first place. But as soon as it began to hurt, because our hearts are soft, we caved in, or did we? We said, it's gone too far. Boys are not doing well at school. Girls, shut up, sit down, be quiet, and let's bring on these boys. Now, there was a good reason for doing that, because disadvantaged males will revenge themselves any way they can. But this isn't really the thinking that lay behind all of this. There was a sudden giddiness, a sudden thought that maybe we're going to win. We never meant to win, we always meant to lose. We meant to fight a heroic battle and lose. We're girls, that's what we do. But in fact, we were nowhere near winning because the cruelty of our culture had increased, because the number of losers had increased exponentially, and the number of winners had dwindled the way to a handful. In an egalitarian system, I almost said a socialist system, then you would have known I was completely mad. Everybody wins. Everybody feels that his life is improving, that she or he is gaining. But in the system we have now, more and more people, our unemployed children, for example, our unemployed grandchildren, our fractured societies are having to register that there are fewer winners than ever. Meanwhile, we are shown these extraordinary people whose contribution to whatever it is, British gas, paper mills, God knows what, are able to invest huge amounts of money offshore so it will never ever be ploughed back into the economy. We've actually seen the rule of the few, the oligarchy, upborne by pseudo-socialist political parties. We've actually seen our society become crueler, harsher, and in particular, harsh to the people whose job is the rearing of the next generation. I'm not just speaking about mothers, by the way, although God knows they've taken a pounding. I'm speaking about all the people involved. People involved in healthcare have lost prestige and wealth and visibility in the community. Teachers, we now have this ridiculous witch hunt against the bad teachers, when if you actually look at the history of teaching in this country, you're astonished that we've got any good teachers. Because one thing is obvious, no one has ever wanted to pay them, let alone to give them the visibility in the social structure that would endorse their efforts. I'm talking about something much more than giving a 17% pay rise. I'm talking about doubling or tripling the pay of teachers. I'm talking about enabling teachers to park a car in the schoolyard that doesn't bring derision from all the kids whose parents work in more lucrative industries and teaching. I'm actually talking about understanding that the rearing and the socialization of the next generation is the most important work anybody does, and much more important than making a whole lot more money and dumping it in some offshore corporation. We are less feminist as a society, even though the rhetoric is feminist, even though you cannot speak in a gendered way. The actual values associated with women's life course are less respected now than they were 30 years ago. Now, I still thought, shut your mouth, go away, don't say anything. Somebody will rise up and speak. Somebody will point out what is blindingly obvious, so obvious it makes your eyes bleed to look at it. And up rose Natasha Walter. Natasha, every word in Natasha Walter's book, The New Feminism, is true. You can have it all. If having it all is having pretty clothes, being feminine, earning more money than men, having a career structure, and being a winner inside an unjust society. Gender is not now the deciding factor in whether you get to oppress other people or not. As far as I'm concerned, this is not a victory, this is a defeat. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that a tremendous con has been practiced, and I blame myself to some extent. When I was a young, braless, hippie, feminist, sleeping with a plethora of men, I had an idea in my head about something called liberation. What we got was something called equality. I don't remember ever arguing for equality. In fact, I can remember saying that I didn't want to be a member of the board of General Motors, that I thought it was really rather more interesting having a child than being a member of the board of General Motors. Equality is in any case spurious. Equality is a bit like everybody having the same sized shoe, but we have different sized feet. So for some of us, equality hurts. For most of us, equality hurts. I am sure that if you're the Fleetwood assassin, you really feel tremendously vindicated in that you're allowed to be a professional boxer. But it's really not what it was all about. Some of us even dream of a world in which boxing would not be a fit occupation for anybody, which no one would ever look at. But this is what we got. We got admittance to clubs that no one in their right mind would ever have wanted to join. And the more I thought about it, I realized that there had in fact been an extraordinary takeover. Everybody thought the equality feminists were good. All they wanted was to do a man's job as well as a man does and be paid a man's salary, no matter what the man's job might have been. The people who wanted liberation were pretty much like people's liberation struggles anywhere in the world. They wanted a recognition of difference. They wanted the difference to be, in the jargon, valorized, to be given value, to be given visibility, to be respected. That's quite different. I can remember arguing at the Oxford Union about equality legislation, and there was a red-faced man in a pink seersucker suit sitting around about there. I learned later that his name was William J. Clinton. And I argued that equality legislation wouldn't give me the right to inhabit my body, would not give me the right to have broad hips, would not give me the right to be hairy, would not give me the right to my own vaginal secretions. There was no way they were going to write those into the law. That I might be allowed to be equal, but I'd still have to be depilated and deodorized and generally acceptable to the people I worked with. I had to somehow conform with the kind of female they thought they could handle. And what they couldn't handle was this Bakhtinian creature I really was, full of projections and holes, full of exudations and protuberances of one sort or another. I wanted, as it were, the right to my protuberances, the right to my transgressions. And no law could give me those. The only thing the law could give me would be a further extension of patriarchal power. I would still be being the perfect daughter. The argument wasn't understood then, and it's not understood now. People still didn't get the argument of the female eunuch, that I was trying to say that here is the female as you tell me I must be, but you might as well tell me to chop off my arms and legs to turn myself into this creature that you know how to deal with. I want the right to be me, just as a colonized person wants the right to be black, to be different, to be, in inverted commas, primitive. I want the right to be female. And my situation is made more difficult because I don't really know what that is. What is it to be female? I know what it is to die of a female disease. I know what it is to have inconvenient states of mind and body that have got to be denied or annihilated or sanitized in some way. Is that it? Is femaleness something to be hidden? Is it kind of diabolical? Or am I going to be allowed to be it, to bring it to you? Here I am. Listen to my biochemical fluxes. Honor them. Honor my pain. Honor my anger. Honor my difference from you. Honor my different set of priorities. If that was what it was all about, then we were really a million miles away from it. And not only that, the more that we asserted it, the more the masculinist establishment cringed away from us. And you know what brings every woman to conscience of this is when she turns 50 or so and realizes she has become the most contemptible creature on the planet. She is an old woman. Women's lives are essentially transformational. At every stage in our development, we are made new. Our horizons retreat. Our vision expands. We become different. I have said, and will doubtless be blamed for saying it, that men kind of make up their minds what they are relatively young. They are an Arsenal fan, a burglar, a banker. Believe me, as I am, this is me, this is what I am. Whereas women are always on their way to becoming something else. To become it, they're a virgin, then they're a non-virgin. They are unimpregnated, and then they're impregnated. They give birth to a child, and that's the most extraordinary transformation. And then they become mothers-in-law, because every mother's fate ought to be, in this heterosexual world, to become a mother-in-law. Then they become old women, and so on. And all the time, from every point of view, menopause is painful because you're actually going over Niagara Falls in a barrel. But when you get to the end of your bruising transit, then you can see things in a way you'd never seen them before. You're actually not the same person. You're not so ego-oriented. Probably never were as ego-oriented as a man, but now less ego-oriented than ever. And each one of these changes is a prise de conscience. You become a wiser, better, more interesting, more complicated person, and at the same time, people lose their desire to talk to you about anything at all. So that your new powers remain a secret, except to other women whose eyes you may occasionally catch on the train. So when all this new feminism business happened, and I thought, my goodness, is this sounding brass all we have achieved in this time? I found that I couldn't sleep, that there was a fire licking at my ribs that woke me up at 2 and 3 in the morning. And there's only one thing to do when that happens, which in my house means that you have to get up, get dressed, go down the path into the office, turn on the computer and start writing, which is what I did for 6 weeks. I wrote until it was over, until it was out. Then I had to think what I had. I put it away. I didn't look at it again for 11 months. I had other books that were contracted for, and I was kind of embarrassed that I hadn't done them, but there were reasons why they weren't the book that was needed. The book that was needed was this book. But was I prepared to do it again? Was I prepared to stand up and be the Aunt Sally, take the flak, fight my way through endless promotion campaigns, TV, radio, blah, blah, because that's what it was going to be. In the end, I decided I didn't have the choice. And the rest is publishing history. That the book went to auction, and as you know, a great deal of money was paid for it, £500,000. Which is not a lot of money when you look at what other people get paid for books, but for a feminist book, believe me, I think it beats the band. But you have to work for that. And the thing that you know is that you are going to be hyped in a way which you find personally revolting. You're going to have to use the marketing tools that you so much despise when they're used normally. You're going to have to, but it's the same as it always was. The only weapons are those weapons. If you're going to fight with any effectiveness at all, you have to use them. You can't decide that you're going to waste your sweetness on the desert air. You can't decide to die pure, especially not in a culture where prostitution is such a growth industry. Writers are all prostitutes. As my friend Flo Kennedy used to say, honey, if you fuck for a dime, you can't complain if somebody else is getting a fur coat. So I figured I was getting a fur coat, although these days I imagine that Flo tells that story in a slightly different way. But it's going to be grim for me, and it's going to be grim for you. You'll be sick of the sight of me. So let me apologize in advance. There are going to be huge billboards all over the place. There are going to be stands in underground stations where people give you chapters of my book to read on the train. When I complained about this to David Hare, he said, I would be over the moon if anybody did that for a book of mine. So I'll stop complaining. But the other thing is, of course, there are going to be spoilers. You're going to read accounts in newspapers that didn't get the serialization of what's in my book and how there's nothing in my book and it's all crap anyway. Bear with me. Trust me. I've done my best and I hope it's good enough. I'm now going to read to you not a chapter from the book, because I rather think I can't do that given the situation that I have with Trans World and the lawyers. You think we have free speech in this country? Give me a break. That's bullshit. I've been working with the lawyers for 6 weeks, and they are still anxious about, you can't say anything about a doctor, for example, in this country. You can't even say he cut off the wrong leg when he clearly cut off the wrong leg because he has a couple of million quid with the medical defense fund that will shut your mouth, whether you're telling the truth or not. So we're going through all of that, and we're going through permissions I've quoted from pop songs. You know, that cost a fortune. We're going to have to take all the pop songs out, so we'll publish them on the internet as a crib to the book. So I'm going to read to you from a chapter which is really very mild, a chapter called Recognition, which in the end has been dumped from the book. And my reason for doing that is that you all read a daily paper. And you've probably got really used to the fact that the daily paper is not telling you anything about women. Now, this is curious, the way they avoid doing this. Now, the example I take is, of course, the great and the good Guardian. In fact, some of the right-wing newspapers are a good deal more woman-positive than the Guardian. But the Guardian is still the repository of piety. Okay, and this is how my rejected chapter goes. If this were really a post-feminist era, we might expect that women and women's affairs had achieved some kind of recognition. In 1970, I harangued the members of the National Press Club in Washington, charging them as newsmakers to look for women to celebrate and for the women's angle on news stories. They looked as if they took to heart what I said. They gave me a National Press Club tie as evidence of their goodwill. Since then, women's media have gone through great changes. It is now accepted that women are sexually active, though not married, and virtually all women's magazines address questions related to sexual activity. You may not believe me, but in the 1960s, the early 1960s, they didn't do that. Romance now includes genital contact, my goodness. Female readers are assumed to work outside the home and to have interests unrelated to husbands and children. Most women journalists are, to some extent, knowingly or unknowingly, lifestyle or closet feminists. The priorities of the mainstream media, however, have changed little. The equality agenda means that issues relating to women have to be presented as if they related to men and women alike. So you read that school children are much more violent than they were before, when what's really meant is that school boys are much more violent than they were before. All the pictures of the violent children are pictures of boys, but in all of the editorial they're called children. The importance of this is, of course, to have ungendered language, which was a good way of obscuring the realities of the situation. Here is an example from The Guardian. On 9th of January 1996, on page 8, under the rubric Home News, The Guardian ran a story by Paul Brown, which was based upon research done by a member of this very university. This article was called Middle Classes Hiring More Servants for Domestic Chores. Above it, and apparently illustrating it, over roughly three times the column inches occupied by the text, was a picture of a male chef in his kitchen gear walking past a Rolls Royce. A chef is, of course, a professional and one of the most highly paid members of a very lucrative industry, and is in no way a servant for domestic chores. The article began, "Domestic servants are being employed in ever-increasing numbers by the English middle classes, though they do not appear in any government statistics according to research presented to the Royal Geographical Society conference in Exeter yesterday. Most of the jobs are not declared, as many servants also draw benefits, and both employer and employee are happy not to tell the state." And so on in the same vein, suggesting that laid-off steel workers on job seekers' allowance were moonlighting as footmen and butlers. The richest 10%, we were told, are now employing the poorest 10% as servants. Although some, this is verbatim from the article, although some are employed as childminders in order to allow their employers to go out to work, many are not. A detailed study in Hampstead showed that many were employed in well-off households where people merely wanted to avoid doing the chores themselves and gain time for extra leisure. Who is it who employs childminders so that they can go out to work? Women, that's who. Who are these childminders? They're women too. Who the women are so they can who employ cleaners so they can take time out for extra leisure is more mysterious, seeing as most women have no leisure whatsoever. But nothing about this article, distilled by Paul Brown from Rosie Cox's presentation, suggested any application of intellectual rigour to a study of the £4 billion paid into the black economy for domestic work. The whole story was about the use that rich women make of poor women, but some asinine consideration of political correctness reduced it to gobbledygook. Occasionally, the real story peeped out. Benefit plus domestic service enabled women to keep body and soul together, it said towards the end of the article, having referred to women as people throughout. The penultimate paragraph gave the game away. In general, the servants are women, whose English is not good enough to get a job outside the domestic sector. Outside London, where there are fewer available immigrants, the women are more likely to be poor English. Now, you see, if that women's story had not been disguised as a people story, it wouldn't have run in the news section of the paper at all. It would have run in the tabloid section as a women's story. You might remember seeing, if you were so unlucky, must be women. Tee-hee. They want no male members, snigger, snigger, in their hallowed precincts. But the move seems inevitable, reflecting the domination of men in senior academic circles. St. Hilda's, the report went on, was struggling to find enough female academics of suitable caliber. Caliber's an interesting word. You could think about that for a while. What does caliber relate to, if not gun barrels? The truth behind this story is that St. Hilda's can't afford to employ as college tutors too many people who are not already in receipt of salary as holders of university teaching posts. The once all-male colleges with the accumulated wealth of centuries are now grabbing all the most qualified women, of whom there are relatively few because of the discriminatory practices and preferences that prevail throughout Oxbridge. And I put in a rather mean thing here. When she accepted a teaching post at Cambridge University in 1996, even feminist Juliet Mitchell chose to accept a fellowship at Jesus rather than at one of the poorer women's colleges. Once more, the pursuit of equality has benefited the dominant class, and this is the underlying dynamic. The old men's colleges now have the best men and the best women, while the women's colleges that went co-educational get the rest. The segregated women's colleges survive because there are enough clever women who realize that there's something very special about an all-women environment. As Dr. Rosalind Miles said of her time at single-sex St. Hilda's, I thought I had died and gone to heaven. Today's undergraduates, aware of the difficulties that beset the female undergraduates at the old men's colleges in Oxbridge, are more passionately attached to single-sex status than their teachers are. And in every case where this question has been raised, it's been the undergraduates who have fought on the barricades to stop the admission of male fellows. And of course, they have mostly failed. Now, I'm going to stop now reading from this because I could go on forever. It goes on more in the same vein. What this chapter that I ditched from the book does is just talk about how, if you look at analysis of the year's events, you'll find that all the people who made news were men, unless they were the Duchess of York or Princess Diana. This was in 1996 and 97. And I also looked at the honours lists. Have you ever thought about the honours lists? The honours lists are bizarre. If you're a man, you get a knighthood, and your wife is called Lady. If you are a woman, you get nothing, mainly, but you may get a damehood, in which case your husband is Mr. Why can't we turn him into gentleman or something? Why can't I be Sir Germain Greer? Why can't we be knights? It is really quite extraordinary. And if you actually look at the sex distribution of the honours, they're even more bizarre, because you end up that women don't get to anywhere near parity till you get to the MBEs, which is known in the corridors of Whitehall as the Secretary's Honour, which is why they get it. And there's another hidden statistic here. How old are the women compared to the men who are collecting their MBEs, and how many of them are in receipt of no salary whatsoever, that their MBE is in lieu of salary for voluntary work? There is wild. But then the other thing is the obituaries. Now, if you look at newspapers, you can say, hey guys, this may come as a huge shock to you, but women are dying. I mean, roughly as many women are dying in any year as men. But you never seem to find any to put in the paper. And then when you do, the picture is from 70 years ago. What are you saying? That since she played a bit part in a movie in the 20s, the rest of her life is a total write-off? I mean, why bother with an obituary at all? You have to actually, the point about newspapers is they don't report the news, they make the news. They can make women visible if they want to, and they don't. This chapter ended up with a discussion of the role played by Mo Molum in the Northern Ireland peace agreement, that while it was a fairly distant possibility, we saw Mo Molum every day. As it got closer and closer, we saw less and less of her. When the peace accord came to be signed, suddenly, bingo, there was Blair and there was Clinton and it was the boys' show. And even in the press conferences, Mo Molum was invisible. She was there, but nobody asked her a question. And she was never required to answer. There is something else going on about Mo Molum and the Northern Ireland Peace Agreement, which is that there's a constant attempt to vilify her and to ridicule her and reduce the importance of her contribution. So the right-wing press is forever publishing little snippets about mistakes she is supposed to have made. I don't know what the ultimate story of all this is going to be, but it was very heartening to me that at the Labour Party conference, she got a standing ovation. It may mean that not all of the people are fooled all of the time. But it's up to us too. It's up to us too to write in to these newspapers and say, did you not notice that such and such a woman died? This is what such and such a woman did for our community. You run this obituary or else. It is shocking to me that 30 years after the female eunuch, I still open my newspaper and find that women have stopped dying. Okay, I promised I'd stop now so that you could talk to me rather than me haranguing you. You're going to get sick of the sound of my voice, I promise you. By the end of next March, you're going to loathe me even more than your least favorite advertisement. At least, I don't promise you, I fear it. In truth, I fear it. So, has anybody a question they would like to ask me at this stage? Well, that fear is sometimes just called misogyny. There's a great dislike of women, and it's hard to like things you're afraid of. I have written a fair bit about masculinity in this book, because I think masculinity is a very cruel system. And I think it's cruelest to men. That men are more afraid of other men than they are of us. And that this is one reason why they express their fear and hatred of us, is because they find no way of expressing it within masculinist organizations. I didn't want to write a whole book about masculinism. There's been a lot of work done on the making of men. But I can see that there is such a thing as phallic anxiety. But I can also see that where it's not our fault. We didn't set the penetration agenda. We don't design the pornography that men watch, for example, just to take an obvious case. Susan Faludi wrote a wonderful article in the New Yorker in which she was talking about what life was like on the set of a pornographic movie. And there was one particular performer who was like a pile driver. She said it was like being on the set of Earthquake 2, as this guy pounded away at this mute and completely dominated female actress. And whose idea is this of what sex is about? It's a masculinist idea. Women didn't set the penetration agenda, and even women's sexuality doesn't demand a penetration agenda. About how men feel about women, I can understand how mothers are unforgivable as far as someone who's been inducted into the masculinist system is concerned, because mothers have such power over you when you're a baby. You know, mothers wipe your bottom and change your napkin and blow your nose and all that kind of thing. And to become a man, you have to reject the mother. That's the bottom line of all masculinizing systems. And if you reject the mother, you reject all women, because they all carry this insignia of potential motherhood. So that concerned me less than women's continual vulnerability to men, and their feeling that men are the proper focus of their attention. So in the book, I tried to suggest that one of the things that happens as you grow out of your reproductive negotiation with men is that maybe you become open to a new kind of love, which is the love of women for women, which I think is, insofar as it's predicated on heterosexual love, is probably misunderstood, and that the great thing about women loving women in their age of wisdom is that they will love as they have never loved before. And that's the point of it. And that strikes me as a better way to be going than trying to find out why it is that men are so alienated from women, especially in England. Yes.
And you were talking about misrepresentation in the media, and one story that raised the lodge was this transsexual lecturer. So sort of in your account, because I'm sure there was a misreport there.
Well, there was a misreport there. The Guardian had to settle out of court and pay a donation to my college and pay my expenses. What actually happened goes like this. This is a kind of a long story. I'll try and make it short. We acquired a new fellow without quite knowing where this new fellow came from or who this new fellow was. And it was only after this new fellow had been sworn in and had agreed to uphold the statutes of the college that I realized that this person was not as other women, and was frightened. It was a bit like finding a man in the toilets when you were at school, because it was at a very private college event, and I had not been given to understand that there was any history here at all. And I didn't know who else knew. I even thought that maybe I was the only person who knew, and that my college had done something extremely ill-advised without knowing that the college had actually done it. It took many weeks to find out what the situation was, and the situation was that Dr. Padman had been absolutely straightforward with the college, had said that she had a prior history as a man, and that appointing her to a fellowship would involve the college in difficulties. She had then been assured by a letter from the principal that there would be no difficulties, but in fact the matter was never discussed. So for those of us who weren't privy to the decision, there was a good deal of puzzlement, because Dr. Padman is not the kind of transsexual who isn't obvious. And so we were being asked questions to which we didn't have the answers. And before we even had the answers, the inevitable happened, which is that the story hit the press. And then I was asked for my comments, and I said, as far as I could tell, we were in breach of our statutes, which say that we only women can become fellows of the college. And the statutes are legal instruments, and we seem to have appointed somebody who was legally male. And as we'd never discussed it, I didn't know if that was the case or not, which was the end of my participation in the affair. I was perfectly good friends with Dr. Padman, and still am, I think, although I haven't heard from her for a long time. But I have to say that one of the arguments of the whole woman is that what is really happening to women in our society is we're being persuaded to deny the reality of our own existence. we're being persuaded to agree that there is nothing special about being a woman, and that a man who is sexually altered may be a woman. And without any history as a woman, without any experience of the oppression that women have to deal with, without any understanding of women's visceral reality, a man who has surgery considers himself entitled to speak on behalf of women, and will do, and will insist upon being allowed into women-only groups, which I regard as typical male behavior. And I may say that having had death threats from members of transsexual pressure groups, they're just the same as any old male death threats. Janice Raymond was being told by Press for Change on the internet that she should invest in flame-proof underwear by her transsexual sisters, because she does not accept transsexual experience as authentic female experience. These are very familiar threats. This is the same old hand across our mouths. The transsexual reserves the right to tell his story as a male-to-female transsexual, but a woman is not allowed to give her version of that story. As far as I'm concerned, that's just straight censorship and straight colonization. And I've always argued against the castration of rapists, because I was fairly certain that a castrated rapist was a murderer, because that was the only offense that was still within his kin. And the difficulty about all of this is there is a good deal of hostility in the mutilation of healthy people in order to become notional females. And I think this is not being confronted. In fact, it's become extravagant now. Male to female sex changes are being carried out on people as young as 16 in Holland, which I think is not defensible, really. Especially as it's not a simple operation. You don't become a woman. It nearly always involves a polysurgery syndrome. You have to have more and more and more surgery. Chin, nose, tits, 500 sessions of electrolysis. It's all money for the surgeons. And I think it's straightforward exploitation of vulnerable people. Nothing will induce me to support it. On the other hand, nothing would induce me either to persecute Dr. Padman as my colleague at Newnham. Dr. Padman taught at Newnham, like many people do who are not fellows in the college. What was strange is that certain members of the college decided to induct her into the fellowship without consulting the fellowship. And any look at what fellowship means in these organizations means that's not on. You don't do that. The fellows have to do it, knowing what they're doing. And it may very well be that if we'd done that, if there'd been a debate, I would have pleaded that it was the wrong thing to do. If I'd been overborne by the rest of the fellows, that would have been fine with me. I mean, I wouldn't have liked it, I would have disagreed with it, but I would have worn it. The problem was that we had no idea how the situation had come about. And I'm not the only one, I was just the media visible one. Yes? I know what the question is. It's fine. I think everybody else does too. Well, you're talking to the feminist who edited the most disgusting pornographic magazine in history, which was called Suck. It was called Suck as a way of distinguishing it from Screw, because Screw, I opined, was a sadomasochistic thing to do. And you can't say to somebody, get sucked. It's not the same at all as get fucked or get screwed or screw you or whatever. But it didn't work. I realized very early on that everything we were getting in our mailbag was sadomasochistic. I tried to short-circuit the dynamic in pornography where you have people who are exposed and people who own them, the kind of classic prostitution syndrome, by exposing myself, in a position in which I could not be ripped off by the mainstream press because it was just too obscene. Imagine that I stood and looked at the lens of the camera through my knees, and you'll get some idea of what the picture actually was. And it's become now a classic of 60s soft-headedness, and I'm prepared to accept that. I think it was a soft-headed thing to do. There was, women cannot exercise power through self-exposure. Expose the penis, the world adores. Expose the female genitalia, the world yawns or throws up, one or the other. So they're just, I can see exactly why feminists are going to fall out over this issue. I can never, ever, ever tolerate censorship, because censorship is what has been used against our reality. So I have to oppose it root and branch. We will say whatever comes into our heads. If you don't like it, tough. And I cannot support the kind of Take Back the Night initiative that was so big in the 80s, because the night was never free. Men are more afraid on the streets than women are, and men get killed on the streets more than women do. So that's not the argument. The argument, you could say, that what we have to do, and what feminists, these feminists, those ones you're referring to, are trying to do, is to rescue pornography and erotic representation so that women are it represented within it, and it represents their erotic feelings and desires. Now, we tried to do this in Suck magazine. I tried to do an issue where it was all bound in very soft rubber membrane, so that you had to break into the paper to read it. I wanted to have pages that were wet and pages that were hairy. But of course, if we did, we'd have won the fucking Turner Prize if we'd done it. So it never happened, because we never had. But not only that, I got ripped off by my five co-editors, who were all men, who foregrounded the picture. They were all supposed to be being photographed in similarly unflattering postures. They didn't do it. They were too smart. I did it, and they published it on page 3 as a pinup, with my signature cut off the bottom of one of my letters, as if it was the sort of thing that you give to fans. I don't think we can conquer pornography, because pornography is basically a commercial relation, basically between services offered to a client. It's basically impersonal. I'm interested to see how the feminist pornographers get on, and I'm very happy to say that I'm one of them, but I think they're beaten before they start. I think that we are losing the men we love to pornography, that they are retreating into a world of virtual sex because it's easier than coping with us. And the stroppier we get, the further out there into cyberspace they go. Just being bad if I say I don't really want to make men feel good? You know, our problem is, one of the things that makes women so sad, one reason why their tears burst out when Diana was so strangely annihilated, is that they carry around them all the time, inside them, this huge load of unrequited love. They love their fathers and either get somewhere or don't, but mostly don't. They love their lovers, they love their children, and the lesson they learn over and over again is that they're less important to all of those people than those people are to them. They learn that lesson with the first breath they take. What are men so afraid of? Are they afraid of this love, this, because it also contains hostility and rage and all the rest of it? I think men's problem is frankly their problem. My problem is the love I bear for you that I can't deal with, that I can't make sensible. I can't even make it realistic. I will go on loving you against all probability. I'll go on believing, even when your fist is in my mouth, that you're doing it because you love me. So, you know, if you feel vulnerable to women, then it's just the wrong feeling. It's not vulnerable to us, you are. It's vulnerable to something else. It's vulnerable to your male agenda that means you can't be seen to be a woman's man. And this is what's so extraordinary about a writer like Julian Barnes, you know. He comes on all the time like a man who is extremely vulnerable to women. And watch how he gets punished for it. Watch, see how unfashionable that is. Yes? This is a very difficult question. It's a question that's been debated by American feminists in particular for a very long time. And I think the agreement is that we don't speak on each other's behalf. There's plenty of room for us both to speak on our own behalf. And there is a dialogue we have to have together. One of the bits of the new book that is going to get me into so much trouble, I've actually written a chapter, for example, on mutilation, which begins with female genital mutilation, which is what everybody's exercised about, and moves to the mutilation that white women practice on themselves, or is practiced on them, like routine episiotomy and cosmetic operations on the vulvae and breast augmentation mammoplasty or reduction mammoplasty or whatever. That these are all mutilations. They're all destructions of healthy tissue for an aesthetic result. In the first decade of women in Mexico City, I actually was the first feminist to raise female genital mutilation in an international forum. I now think that that was an improper thing for me to have done. That question should have been raised by somebody who understood the situation in its cultural context and was arguing from first-person experience. It's always been a tenet of feminism that whatever evidence you give must be first-person before it's anything else. You speak of the reality that you know. We only have one kind of authenticity as women. We don't have authority. We have authenticity because it's worn into our flesh is where it comes from. So the only thing I would say to you is I would not speak on behalf of a black feminist or an Asian feminist or an Islamic feminist if she was there to speak for herself. But if she is not there to speak for herself, then I'll do my best to see that her position is not preempted by anybody else. But that's about as far as it can go. I mean, this is the problem with feminism. Because we don't have a fascist organization, because we don't have mind police, because there is no orthodoxy imposed, because we work as hard in peace politics and in green politics and in animal rights and in transsexual rights and homosexual rights and for against AIDS and all this kind of thing, because our energies are spread over such an area, we have no cutting edge. And It may be that if things get much worse, we're going to have to think in terms of the kind of terrible consensus that the Labour Party now imposes upon its new parliamentary members. But so far we haven't had to do that, and I hope that we don't ever have to do it. I hope that it's understood that feminists speak in a number of voices, that there are feminisms, and black feminism is one of them. If there are no women present, well, I suppose, yes, they could say, you know, sure. But they have to understand. What I don't really, what I would not accept is for any man to define the aims of feminism, or indeed to say that he has understood them, or that he can cope with them, or that he accepts them, or that he is a feminist. That I will not allow. Ever. Yes? The thing about pornography is that it's inexhaustible. If you fulfill one fantasy, you have to develop another one because that gets blah. So you have to keep upping the ante, you have to keep making it more titillating, more exciting, more extreme, and so on. This is how it has become an exponentially expanding market. Now, even though marriage guidance counselors used to tell people who were having sexual difficulties in their relationship that they should read pornography together, I don't agree at all. I think that's like turning your marriage into a brothel, that's actually distorting the nature of your interaction, making it something mechanical, fantasy-ridden, alienated from immediate reality. So you're not actually making love to a person, you're making love to a set of fantasy clues or cues that are given to you by that person. I don't think you can co-opt pornography, and I don't think you can get pornography to work for you if you're a woman. I honestly think that for us who feel that this degradation has come into our relationship, the only thing to do is to withdraw from it, to become less accessible, and thereby to become more interesting. I can't guarantee that it's going to work, but you might be less humiliated than you would be if you were getting all dressed up and playing games and pretending to be surprised in your bedroom by your husband jumping out of a wardrobe or having to wear rubber or, you know, wear a French basque and come on like a trollop. I don't see that that's a way to. It might be a way to get a man to come relatively quickly, but I don't think it's a way to keep a family together or to keep a relationship together. But there are plenty of people who would disagree. There are plenty of people who think that game playing is an essential part of sexuality and should be built into adult relationships. I still carry around me this kind of vague memory of something called passion that didn't need any toys or basques or split crotch panties or any of that shit, or even amyl nitrate. I mean, you could just get it on, you know. But I, you know, maybe I'm old-fashioned purist perfectionist, and you may notice I haven't got a partner. But I've got great memories of partners. And I don't have an embarrassing drawer full of rubber trousers. So I don't think you can. You cannot control pornography. You cannot control fantasy. What you're going to I just think that's you're on a hiding to nothing.
Come up with new that perhaps you women who may be used to understand
and Anne Summers' party plan has me all beaten to a pulp. You may well be right. They certainly make a lot more money than I do, even with my advance. But I think that women who are involved in capitulating to male fantasy find it very alienating and very disturbing and really don't enjoy it all that much. And I don't approve, I don't want to be seen to support the kind of cosmopolitan culture that says that you should capitulate to male fantasy and play roles in male fantasy, because that way you lose touch with your own authenticity. I mean, whose orgasm is this anyway? And I think that's the thing, because it's always reactive. You're always playing a part in somebody else's script. If you're not, if it's really the case that you are the inventor of the script and that the game, the fantasy game you're playing is your fantasy game, then that's a different situation. But this is not what I see. You can spend £150 a week on pornographic magazines published weekly in this country. That's how many there are. And not one of them is for women. And it's not in the women's sock drawer that these magazines are being hid. They're not a women's thing. And I think that's just a fact. And maybe it's true that younger women think that the cool and the hip thing is to get into all that and be all things to all men. But I think they're being even further alienated from their own sexuality if that's the course that they follow. That their own sexuality is differently organized. And I think it's more interesting, more whole body, more responsive, more erotic, and less stressful. I mean, phallic anxiety is real. Why are all these poor bastards running around trying to pay £5 a pill for Viagra? Because they can't get it up. Why can't they get it up? Well, because they've probably had it up far too many times already. And for the wrong reasons. I mean, imagine, you know, you pay £5 for a pill so you can pay another £5 for a magazine so that you can jack off. Give me a break. Life is too short. Yes. Sure. But when I spoke about winners and losers, I was actually thinking much more in terms of economics. And I was thinking more in terms of competition than conflict. And the way, I mean, if you look at the structure of anything, look at the structure of sport. It's not worth playing a sport unless you can be the top. That's the way we express it. So we have a super league in football, and so on and so forth. And this is really what I was talking about. Not winners and losers in the sense of a knockdown, drag-out fight, but in terms of competition. So that while we talk all the time about empowering people, about social exclusion and so on, we actually increase the amount of social exclusion by making success so inaccessible for most people. And I would argue that that dynamic has increased in the last 30 years. So that the idea of, you know, of success even as a breadwinner for a family has become less attainable for people. That simple gratification of saying, you know, I keep a roof over my children's heads has become harder. So I wasn't really talking about it simply in that sense. Now, my problem is not that women are fleeing from dialogue with men. I just don't, that's not what's happening. You see, I'm not even talking in those terms at all. What I see is women moving ever closer to men, striving to be more honest, more straightforward, closer, more intimate, and men moving away. I see a flight from women. Not that all men are bastards, except it occurs to me that men maybe like men better than they like women, whether they love us or not. And that's a big distinction between them and us. And I want women to like women more, because it would make them less vulnerable to the men who are forever becoming more parsimonious with their closeness. You see? So I'm not actually talking in those terms. What worries me is a flight from real women. Now, that expresses itself in lots of different ways. A beautiful young woman said to me the other day that she was terribly embarrassed during the summer, because she'd been in the Club Mediterranee or wherever, and she was running along the beach, and the guys all started laughing because her tits went up and down, and the Baywatch girls don't. So they thought that there was something inferior about her real tits. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a flight toward of men away from real women towards fantasy objectives which are being sold to them all the time, so that they find us all. We all have something to apologize for. According to Loaded, the worst thing any woman can have is a fat ass. Every woman has a fat ass. It's hormonally determined. If you've got no fat on your ass, you're a man. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Pamela Anderson might as well be a Barbie doll or might as well be a transsexual, because the body is so freakish that it is not a real female body at all. And this is what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about us saying all men are bastards. It's a different thing. It's, where are you going? Why are you not listening to me? Why am I unimportant to you? What is your mind really running on? Because it's not running on me as your companion, your friend, your partner. But this is partly also because heterosexual society only allows one relationship, which is the heterosexual couple. And it's non-viable. It's too claustrophobic, it's too unequal, it's too threadbare. We need more contacts, we need emotional contacts of a different kind. We need brothers and sisters. We talk about brothers and sisters all the time. Look at the demography. Fewer and fewer of us have ever had a brother or a sister. What are we going to predicate this relationship on? Well, we have to rebuild it. And the only way to rebuild it is to weaken the heterosexual rhetoric that controls our notions of worthwhile relationships. It doesn't for men, but it does for women. And this is an asymmetry. Read the little girl's press. It's all about relations with boys. Read the boys' press. It's all about fishing, cars, whatever. Now, this is the asymmetry that breaks our hearts. And it's within our power to change it. We have to turn away. We have to withdraw. You know what they say? Good fences make good neighbors. We need to build a fence.
Come on, I don't want to be misunderstood here.
God forbid!
That is a moment perhaps where we should stop, because of booking arrangements.
Well, in that case, let me just say thank you so much for being a wonderful audience for me tonight. I'm really happy to be here and happy to be at Warwick. Thank you.